Hey guys, I'm Jennifer, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi Jennifer, we love you Jennifer, lots and lots and lots.
How much?
Oh.
It's amazing, it never gets old. At least when you're up here. When y'all are doing it for everybody else, it annoys me really bad. It's not a YPAW until you set off the fire alarm or the police show up. So I've often said that the Saturday night is so long, there needs to be like an intermission before the speaker because it just goes on forever and young people don't have the attention span. So God heard the prayers and you're welcome to all the smokers and vapors. So it's such an honor and privilege to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and to be asked to do anything, whether it's participating at my home group, by greeting people, making coffee, and certainly sharing my experience, strength, and hope. Because I can tell you, when I was 90 days sober, I heard this woman tell her story. And I had just turned 15 years old. I got sober 6 days before my 15th birthday. And when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, the people didn't look like you. They were very old, like as dirt, you know, and had been sober since God. And I had nothing in common with that. And I heard this woman tell her story, and she had curly red hair. And I hated my red hair. Ever since I was a little girl, I'd rip it out. But I heard her tell her story, and she got sober when she was 13. And I thought, man, if she can do it, maybe I can. You know, and then at once I had 30 days, I remember thinking, man, if I can just help one person the way that the people in Alcoholics Anonymous helped me. So it's really powerful to be able to talk about my experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous and to remember where I came from. Because oftentimes in my life today, you know, I can beat myself up thinking, oh, I'm supposed to be here, or I should be doing this, or why am I, you know, not this or that, comparing my insides to other people's outsides, you know. And the reality is that I live a life that the majority of human beings anywhere in this country would give a left arm for. I am blessed beyond measure, and getting to share my story really gives me the ability to tap back into where I came from, because I am just one of those people that was a complete degenerate when I got to you, you know, and I was an unlovely creature, and I had an inability to develop relationships with other human beings and connect with people, and I hated myself and I hated all of you. And today, you know, I feel freedom. You know, I sleep at night and I have peace in my head and my heart. I can look the world in the eye, and it's only because of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. My job tonight is to share with you in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I thank the committee so much. My host, the speakers this weekend, like, it's been an amazing conference. It's been impressive to me because I get asked to speak a lot. And, you know, the thing is that I don't always hear speakers that talk the way that I talk, meaning I have current experiences of writing inventory. I have current experiences of making amends because I have to work really hard at this. And some people, they wake up and they're lovely human beings and they're just grateful. I am not that. I wake up every day and you know who I think about? Me. None of you. I have to work really hard. And that's just the kind of alcoholic that I am. The way that I drank was the same way. Hard. Fast. The reason I got here as quick as what I did was because of how I do things. I have fast and faster. Those are my two speeds. Nothing in between. And so for me, you know, I want all the freedom. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to live a mediocre life. Once I received this gift, I realized I don't want to live a mediocre life. I want it all. And so that means that, you know, who I am today is different than who I was, you know, last year. And we heard that last night from our speaker. And the Al-Anon speaker this morning was phenomenal. If y'all, I know most of y'all missed it because I was there. And y'all weren't. So, but I will tell you, she was powerful. So by the tape, it was really, really powerful. And this is a family disease, and I'm one of those people too. My mom is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She's sober 20 years now. And hopefully I'll get to share some of that experience of how she landed in Alcoholics Anonymous, because my first AA meeting ever was with her. when she was sentenced to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was about 5 years old, and it was right next to the bar. That was my favorite place to go when I was a little kid, was the bar. I loved that place. It was a nasty, dingy, like you would walk across the floor, your feet would stick to it. It smelled like urine. I loved that place. And when I was a kid, if you asked me, where do you want to go? It would have been Bentley's every time. I loved it. Because they would, like, give me, you know, tips and let me wipe. I wanted to be a waitress when I grew up. Like, that was my aspiration in life at, you know, the age of 5, 6 years old, is I wanted to be just like my mom. Because she was everything that, in the exterior, I wanted to be. In Texas, everybody has big blonde hair, and that's where I grew up. And my mom had blonde hair. She's petite and tiny. I'm not petite and tiny, nor will I ever be, right? Like, we're just very different. I have this flaming red hair, and I would go to school, and I was the only human with red hair. Everybody had blonde hair, and I hated myself. But what I know today is that my whole life growing up, I thought that that was why I was different. And the reality is that the difference was inside here, and I just didn't know it. It was the thing that I could look at and go, this is what makes me different, and I'm broken because of this. And if I just look like this, I would be okay. And if I was just older, I would be okay. And if I was just this, I would be okay. And I can get like that in my life today. If I'm just this, everything will be better. And the reality is that Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me how to live life on life's terms today and be at peace. And some days I do that really well, and some days I do not do that very well. So I grew up in Texas. I have an older brother, a younger half-sister. Never talk about my sister because we didn't grow up in the same household. I grew up in a household that was, my parents split up when I was 3. And it was just, they fought over us. And we ended up going to live with my father and my stepmother, who my father had married 6 months after they split up. She has extreme mental illness. She was diagnosed with multiple personalities. So as a child growing up in an environment like that, one minute everything would be okay, and then the next minute everything was not okay. Things would be flying. We would be getting beat. There was, like, torturous things that occurred in our household. And, you know, I say that to say that for a long time, the reason I thought I was broken was because of what happened. I thought that the environment I came from was what was wrong with me, even when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I said I was an alcoholic because when I got here, that's what you people did, and I just happened to land in these meetings, and I'll explain how that happened. But in my mind, I didn't associate that that had anything to do with alcoholism. I thought it was because if I just had a normal life, if I could have been with my grandparents. And when we were 8 years old, my brother and I, we ran away. I see 8-year-olds today and I think, God, that's crazy. Because 8-year-olds normally just don't think about running away. It's just not a normal thought process for most 8-year-olds. I would watch TV and I would see these kids get abducted and I would think, man, why can't somebody abduct me? You know, like, I literally hated being in that house. It was terrible. And I hated going to school because at school I was like the weird, awkward girl. I mean, I look at pictures of myself now and I was like, I was a cute kid, you know, like there was nothing wrong with me. But I had this curly red hair and I just hated myself. And I see pictures now and I'm like, I don't understand what the big deal was. But at that time, I just felt, no matter where I was at, not okay. Again, none of these environmental things is what makes me alcoholic. My first drink was with my mother. I was 8 years old when I had my first drink. My mom had gotten in a fight with her then husband, who she had remarried. They only stayed married for a really short period of time, but she got in a fight with him, and my job was always to take care of mom because my mom was never a mom to me. My mom didn't learn how to be a mom until she was 8 years sober. And my entire life, I always wanted to have a mom, because if there's anybody in this world that I know loves me, and I feel it and know it, it is that woman. And I love her with every part of my being, and I always have. But she never showed up. She was not there. She was completely incapable. And my job was to cheer her up, was to make her happy. And she got in a fight with him, and so I was doing my little thing, and it's really embarrassing, so I won't do it from here, but I was doing this thing that would kind of make her laugh, and she said, let's go, and grab me, and we got in the car, and she went to the 7-Eleven that was right across from the bar, and she got a six-pack, and she handed me a beer. And I remember holding the beer up, because I was like, yeah, I've arrived, because I knew that what happened in that place called Bentley's that I loved was that everybody was cheerful, jolly, wonderful, and they were drinking. Now, I also had these other thoughts, because we ended up going to live with my grandparents, and my mom was never capable of raising us. We lived with my grandparents until I graduated from high school. But I remember, and I remember sitting, looking out the window almost every night, crying, wanting my mom to come home because I was terrified she was going to get in another one of those accidents. So even though I had this one perspective about alcohol of wanting to be a part of that, I also had this terror and fear when it came to my mother, and I just knew she was going to die. And I've had that fear of my mother dying. Of course, my mom talks about dying all the time, so that probably doesn't help. She's been doing that our whole lives, but now I do it. So everybody's like, could you please quit talking about dying? I'm like, well, when I do, you know. I've actually told people they get something if they smother me, because I don't want to be one of those people who just keeps going, you know. Put me down. Like, if I'm not myself, put me down. So anyway, it's a whole nother topic. I know, I'm super weird. So where was I at? Mom drank, ate. So and so I had this feeling about mom, about her always like something happening to her, because I would wake up in the morning sometimes and it looked like her clothes had been dipped in blood because she'd gotten into yet another accident. Around this time is when she got sentenced to AA, which is when I went to my first AA meeting. What I did not know that it was AA. I just went, and it was a bunch of old people smoking cigarettes, and I would sit on the floor. Clearly, she did not get sober, and we continued to live with my grandparents. And when we were, and I didn't become like a daily drinker at 8 or at 10, but I knew that I wanted to be a part of that. And when I was 10 years old, my brother and I, my brother was having a friend sleep over who I had a crush on. And we decided that we were going to play quarters. And I don't know why or how we knew how to play quarters. It was just we inherently knew how to do that. And we climbed up. I remember everything. It was the excitement. Like, I loved the excitement of, like, when I was getting ready to, you know, go do whatever I was going to go do. Because I knew I was getting ready to experience relief, right? Like, I was doing something bad. I always loved that. I liked being dared to do things. I just had that adrenaline junkie thing going for me. And so I remember climbing up there, getting that bottle and running upstairs, and we just started playing quarters. And that first shot, when that whiskey hit the back of my throat, it burnt like fire, and I felt it all the way down my esophagus till it hit the pit of my stomach. And when it hit the pit of my stomach, I felt like I could breathe for the first time in my life. And everything in my body went warm, and I felt okay. They dared me $20 that night. I couldn't finish that bottle of whiskey, and down it went. Because I like a good dare. Now, the real magic wasn't just the way that that alcohol felt when it hit the back of my throat, because I did also love that. What I loved most was later on in the evening, and I think this was after I punched my brother's friend and knocked him down the stairs because I didn't need him anymore. But it was when I was being really loud and obnoxious, and I was laying on the couch, and I was looking up, and the whole room was just spinning. And my brother was saying these terrible things to me, because he called me terrible names when we were growing up. He was very mean to me. And I could hear him in my ears, but I didn't hear him in my heart. That is the power of what alcohol did for this alcoholic. It no longer mattered what my brother thought about me. It no longer mattered what that boy thought about me. And when alcohol is in this girl's body, I don't care about anything. Nothing. Everything is okay and at perfect peace in the world. All is well. It doesn't matter what you think of me. Nothing matters. All of that selfishness and self-centeredness was quieted. I didn't know that I had selfishness and self-centered at the age of 10. But what I know today from going through the steps and doing a lot of work in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the knowledge that I have of myself, I did not have when I got here. I didn't have when I had 5 years sober. I didn't have, it came piece by piece by piece. So if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I encourage you, you know, just keep coming back. And I know it's such a cliche thing that we say here, right? But it's so important. It was so important for this alcoholic, for me to have those experiences. And so... You know, that night I like fell down the stairs, I wet my pants, I left my DNA all over that house. I was vomiting blood. I was violently ill. And I remember they called two places. I was like in a blackout the majority of that. Like sometimes I would come out, I remember my brother, I could smell his cologne. It was like polo green. Ugh. And that smell to this day is like, ugh. And I couldn't eat oranges for a long time because we also had found some orange triple sec, and it took me about 5 years before I could ever drink orange juice or any oranges. So anyway, they called two places that night. They called Alcoholics Anonymous, and they called my favorite uncle. The reason they called my favorite uncle is because he drank all the time, and they knew he would know what to do with me. I'm going to go ahead and tell this story now because oftentimes I'll forget. When I was 6 months sober, for me, what happened when I got here is, again, I said that I was one of you. I said I was alcoholic because that's what you people said. I didn't understand the nature of what alcoholism was or that I was actually afflicted with it 100%. I knew I was in a ton of pain and I needed relief and I was willing to come to these stupid meetings. That's all I knew. And I did everything that was suggested for me to do when I got here. All of the stupid things. 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, life started to get a little bit better. I started to feel better. I wasn't obsessing about drinking every single day anymore. Then this thing happened, my ego returned. I started having ideas of how my life could turn out differently. And I probably wasn't that bad, and I wasn't like you. I didn't get a DUI, I didn't have a driver's license or a car, but like I start having these thoughts. And to me, that's my ego returning because I have a plan. I know what to do. The great thing about when I got here is that I was broken and I no longer had a plan. So if you don't have a plan and you don't know what to do, you are in the right place. You are perfect ready for Alcoholics Anonymous. So those things had started to happen and I was having these thoughts and, you know, what about graduation? What about if I ever get married? I mean, I didn't have a boyfriend or any of those things, but these are the things I'm thinking of as to, you know, this grief process that occurs because I had figured out, y'all had said 24 hours at a time, just don't take a drink one day at a time. But then I realized, oh, this is actually for the rest of your life type of a thing. You people keep doing this, you know? And so I couldn't fathom that. And when I was 6 months sober, I came home from school and all of my family was there. It was super weird. And what had happened is my aunt and uncle had gotten into a big fight and my aunt, my uncle left the room. She later came out, and when she came out, the phone book had been opened up to treatment centers because what they were fighting about was his drinking. And after a week, she hadn't been able to locate him in any treatment center, and she decided to send people out to start looking for him because she was concerned that maybe he wasn't in treatment. They found him behind the house, and he'd shot himself with a shotgun. And that day there was a conversation that was had and they were talking about whether or not he was going to go to heaven or hell because he had committed this mortal sin, which my family never went to church, so I don't know how they became like theologians all of a sudden. But the clearest thought came to my mind in that moment, and it was powerful. And the reason I believe that came to mind was because I'd been coming here and I'd been doing this thing. I'd been working with a sponsor, and that thought was, I understand how he felt when he pulled the trigger. He didn't die because he killed himself. He died of alcoholism. That was when my first step to my innermost self was complete. When I got here, people said, some people die so that others can stay sober. That was my experience. Because him dying had such a powerful impact on my life. Because that fourth step that I was resisting writing, I started writing it. I got it done. It didn't take months to do a fourth step. It took 2 days. It was the months that I procrastinated, but whenever that old biker said, shut up, sit down and write, and I did that, I was then able to go and read that inventory to a sponsor, and I started working the steps. And it says in the 12 and 12, I think it's one of the last two paragraphs, it talks about why some of us don't stay and we don't make it. If we don't believe that this is a life and death errand, why would we continue on to do these things? I don't like writing inventory. I do not like telling anybody that I am wrong. That is physically uncomfortable for me. Because guess what? I have pride, ego, all of these things. That is coming from a place of humility. It is uncomfortable for me. I remember calling my sponsor. I don't know. I was probably like 8 years sober or something. And I was explaining this feeling I was having. And she said, it sounds like you're neutral. And you're like in a place of being humble. And I was like, I don't like it. Right? Like, that's not a comfortable state for me. I like feeling powerful. I love power. And my literature tells me lack of power is my dilemma. It's my dilemma, meaning I have two equal ugly alternatives, right? Go to the bitter end or accept spiritual help. I never want to do those things. I never want God to be my solution. And so, you know, that's what happened. To my uncle, and it changed my recovery. It changed my life. And thank God. And so that's another reason why I say keep coming back. Because had I not kept coming back, that wouldn't have been my experience. And my life changed as a result. And I was able to identify my alcoholism and understand what that meant. Because no matter what, if I pick up a drink, I will always get to a place that it makes complete sense for me to take my own life. And I don't believe whatever creator is out there created any of us to destroy ourselves. It is a natural reaction to find food, shelter, to stay alive and take care of ourselves. But alcohol always takes me to a place that it makes complete sense and seems like the only solution. So again, I wasn't a daily alcoholic at the age of 10, but I knew what my solution was. And it wasn't like this clear conscience thought, but it was the power that happened and the magic that happened and not caring what you people thought about me, because I cared what you thought about me every day of my life, although I didn't know it because I was taught you do not experience fear and you don't ever let anybody know that you're scared. So I developed a lot of protection things in my life as a young child because it was required. And so I didn't know how to identify different things when they were going on within me. But by the time I was 11, I started getting my older cousins to buy us alcohol, to go to parties, always hanging out with older kids. My brother's a year older, so his friends were always older, and it just worked out really well for me, right? By the time I was 12, it was a regular basis that I was drinking on at least every weekend. By the time I was 13, I hit my first treatment center. What I learned in treatment is drugs are bad, just say no, because in my mind, they were illegal. I mean, I don't know where it's legal for a 13-year-old to drink, you know, liquor every day, but somewhere in my head, it was legal for me to do that, but drugs are illegal. Like, there's the whole just they know thing that happened. And so I was like, okay, but alcohol is a liquid. There's no way it has power over my life. So I thought, I'm going to go get drunk with everybody I was in treatment in. And during that time in treatment, a lot of things happened. You know, I kicked the window out. I went AWOL. I was just one of those defiant, insane people. So when crazy people talk in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm like, oh, that's my people. Because I'm extreme in everything that I do, just the way that I think, the way that I react, respond, it's just insanity. And so I really identify with people like that. And so I got out of treatment. I got drunk with everybody I was in rehab with. And during that time when I was in treatment, I met this girl named Abby. And I had never really had a girlfriend. I always hung out with my brother and his friends, even though they were mean to me and they would, like, pick on me. They were terrible. Most people would refer to what they did to me very abusive. But in my mind, it was like they were my friends. And I was just, like, tagging along because I just wanted to feel safe somewhere. And I never really had girlfriends because I felt different and odd because I had this red hair and they all had this blonde hair and they were cute and I wasn't cute. And I had a hard time connecting. And it wasn't because I was intimidated they were going to go out with the guys. I was intimidated because I just wasn't enough and I wasn't good enough. And so I met this girl, Abby, and she was super cool. She was like punk rock girl, and I just thought, man, she is awesome. And she was really trying to do this sober thing. And I was like, that's weird. And so I would take her to parties with me and I would set up shot glasses and I'd fill them up with water so that she could have fun with us, you know, drinking. And what happened is through about 6 months time period, eventually she came to me, and this was about 3-4 months before I got sober. And she said, I'm not going to continue to watch you kill yourself. And I was like, that's dramatic, you know, like, I'm not trying to kill myself, bye, you know, and that's literally what I did. It was I sent her on her way, and so when it talks about no human power could have relieved me of my alcoholism, that was my thing, and I didn't realize that at the time. It wasn't until I went through the steps with a sponsor that I was able to identify the only person who mattered in my life at that time, because nobody cares about their parents when they're 13, 14 years old. I cared about what she thought. And I loved her. She was the first girlfriend I'd ever had. And I was like, bye. And I continued doing what I did, you know. And my experience is that when I see girls that are 13, 14, 15 years old, it hurts my heart today. And the reason why it hurts my heart is because the way that I was living my life, it was like a 30-year-old woman. I was hanging out with people who I referred to as my friends, that I referred to them as pedophiles today because that's what they were. Because I was living my life like a 30-year-old. I was 13, 14 years old. I was running the streets. I was, you know, doing all of the things. And I became a daily drinker. I kept half-gallon jugs of vodka everywhere hidden in my closet. First thing I did when I woke up, I'd splash a little bit of orange juice in a big old glass of vodka right before I went to school. And then I would do whatever anybody handed me while I was at school, because I was a degenerate. And people would give me things. And then when I got out of school, I would come home and I would drink my face off until I passed out. And my life became this thing where I was non-existent. And my soul at some point in time during that era left my body. And I became a shell of a person. And my grandparents were great human beings. My granddaddy was like hardworking, loved his family, would give you the shirt off his back. My grandmother was just as sweet as can be. She always called me her little redheaded angel. And when I got sober, she said that my halo hangs around my ankles. And but she was so naive. She would never think that me and my brother were doing the things that we were doing. And they instilled some values, even though early on in my life, I might not have had any kind of stability or, you know, security and developed, I still knew right from wrong. And it wasn't like it was this conscience thing. It was my life started becoming more and more normal, the more insanity that was evolving around me. And I was completely okay with it. Because I would just go lower and lower whenever I felt lower and lower to make sure that I still would be okay amongst the people that I was surrounding myself with that became pedophiles and, you know, just the worst of the worst. Those were the people I hung out with. And I had bleeding ulcers. I was very sick. I was emaciated. You could count all my ribs by the time that I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, which is kind of funny because, and I also got to the place where I wanted to kill myself. But, you know, for years I was always like, I wasn't that bad. I wasn't a low bottom drunk, you know. I just wanted to kill myself. And, you know, like, because that's what my alcoholic mind does, you know, even when I come here and I get sober. And so what happened was my last night drinking, it wasn't like that night was the worst night that I had had. I'd tried to kill myself multiple times before. That night was different. I no longer had a plan of how to kill myself. I was at a place where I was completely broken, and I just wanted to die. And I was willing to do something I'd never done before. And I said a prayer. And that wasn't God help me. I didn't want help. I knew in that moment, and what I believe my higher power gave me was the ability to see life for the truth. And the truth was that the world would be better off without me. The type of person that I had become, the world deserved better than who I was. And that was truth. That wasn't self-deprecation. I was a terrible human being. And I said, please make my heart stop. Don't let me wake up tomorrow. And of course, like, I did wake up because here I am. And when I woke up, that same fear, terror, bewilderment was still with me. And I had no solution to continue to live. I didn't know necessarily that it had to do with alcohol. I just thought there was something broken in me. And that day, I got a phone call, and it was from that girl, Abby, I'd met in treatment. What are the odds that she would call me on January 12th of 1992? The night after I had prayed and asked God to kill me, she called me and she asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was like, no, like that is absolutely not what I want to do. Because again, I'm like in this terror of how do I fix what is so broken? And I had no solution. And for whatever reason, I said, I'll go with you because I had no other solution. And I think I really just wanted to see her. Thank God she stayed in contact and made that call to me. And so I walked into this trailer in, you know, Arlington, Texas, and these, you know, people who had been sober since forever and were old as dirt. And when I got to you people, it wasn't just that I was isolated in this sense that I'd cut myself off from everybody. I'd shaved half my head. I wore combat boots. I wore, like, white on my face and black lips, black eyes. I was the scary-looking human being, right? Like, nobody goes up to the person who looks really scary and says, how's your day going? Like, they just leave you alone, you know? And what I know today is that that was just one more way to keep you away from me because the isolation was so deep. And so I walk in looking like that to these old men, like Santa Claus beard suspenders, like old people. And I mean, when you're 14, everybody's old, but they were really old. And even today, I would say they were old. And so I wasn't told that I was too young. That wasn't my experience. I wasn't treated differently because I was 14. I was welcomed into Alcoholics Anonymous. Those old guys didn't tell me where the coffee was. They brought me over a cup of coffee. And they shared with me the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, which was their experience, strength, and hope. They didn't tell me what I needed to do. I mean, eventually they did tell me what I needed to do, but they called it suggestions. But they also said that, you know, we suggest you wear a parachute when you jump out of an airplane. So they expressed why the weight as to what I needed to do in my life. And so I'll forever be grateful that that's the meeting I walked into. They didn't treat me, they didn't yell at me because I said that I was an alcoholic and an addict. I did that for, even when I moved to North Carolina, I was still doing that. They would be like, would you please stop doing that? Because North Carolina is like super strict. Like they don't even like it if you curse, like any curse words. They say it at every meeting. And I didn't know how to say a sentence without using the F word at least 5 or 6 times. So it was difficult. They would be like, when I moved to North Carolina, a lot of people think that's when I got sober. I was 3.5 years sober. And so you can imagine what I was like at 15 when I really didn't care. And the reason why it was so important that they met me where I was at was that had they not, I would have told them what they could do with what they had. I would have left. And they didn't try to change me. They would just share their experience, strength, and hope with me. And I have to remember that whenever I'm sharing with anybody, it's about my experience. It's not about telling you what to do. Man, when I'm in a meeting and somebody is telling me what I need to do, I literally want to get up and just punch them in the throat. I'm like, you're not the boss of me. Nobody's the boss of me, right? Like, I'm so defiant. And it was so important that what they shared was their experience. And it's important for me to pass that on to other people. And so I started going to these meetings because I was in enough pain. I was willing to do all the stupid things. And they said, you know what? You got to do 5 things. And if you do these 5 things, you don't have to drink ever again. And I was like, okay, what are the 5 things? And they said, pray in the morning. And I was like, sorry, I don't believe in God. And they said, I didn't ask you if you believed in God. I told you to pray in the morning. And I was like, well, that doesn't make any sense. They said, do the physical action. You don't have to believe. Just get on your knees and say, whatever's out there, help. That's how my prayer life began. And I can tell you that my biggest struggle through Alcoholics Anonymous, because I never want my solution to be God, it's with prayer and developing this relationship with God. I've done all kinds of things through my journey of being sober. I converted to like being Catholic when I was like 10 years sober. I've gone to Buddhist things. I go to sweat lodges. I mean, you name it, I've tried it in terms of seeking what is out there. I no longer know any more today than what I did when I got it here, what is out there. And the more I try to figure it out, I mean, I've gone to every church, everything. It doesn't resonate with me. And what I know my experience to be is that it doesn't have to feel anything. It has to do with my actions. And my actions are that whether I believe or I don't believe, I just hit my knees. And what happens is my life gets better. And one day at a time, the obsession was removed. One day at a time of doing those things consecutively, I started not obsessing about drinking. And then I realized, wow, I haven't obsessed about drinking. And at night, I would thank whatever was out there, which I also thought was stupid because I still thought in my head I was doing it. But what I know today is that I haven't done any of this. My higher power sets everything up. I just like to get credit for all the, like, if you say I did a good job, thank you. What I know today is that it's not about what I say or what I, you know, it's not about me. It's about my higher power carrying this message. You know, and for a long time, I did service. I was involved in every conference committee. I did all of the things. And a lot of that service was serving myself and my ego. And I had to learn how to allow God into my life. And I did that through great suffering and great pain because that's the only way I like to learn. It says that we can learn by great love, but it's rarely that for me. It's usually suffering and pain because I'm just stubborn in that way. And so I started doing all the things. You know, my uncle, you know, he died when I was 6 months sober. And you know, like I think I was in the 9th grade when I got sober. It was tough. Because when you're in the 9th grade, the only thing that matters are your friends. I was not cool, even through high school, not cool chick, because I didn't know how to talk to anybody my own age. My BFFs were senior citizens. I played Pictionary on Friday night, okay? And when I was feeling real crazy, I'd go to an NA dance. When we were doing the sobriety countdown, I remember going to this retreat, and it was an NA retreat, and that's where I went to my first sobriety countdown. And I was like, man, this is so cool. Young people's wasn't big where I got sober at all. I didn't go to a young people's conference till I was 3.5 years sober. But what I did do was I got connected with a group of alcoholics that helped me get through the steps. I had a sponsor who, I say my sponsor and the people that I came in contact with in early recovery, they loved me. I'm going to explain what love is to me. It's truth. It doesn't feel like love. You know, because when I think of love, I just think of like, oh, the gushy, pretty stuff. Ask anybody who's been married 60 years if they love their person every single day. The answer's no, right? Like sometimes it's ugly and you hate the person, you want to strangle them. Well, that's the same thing. And if you don't feel like punching your sponsor at least once or twice, I suggest get a new sponsor, because my experience is I have been violently angry at pretty much every sponsor I've ever had. First time I read Inventory, I was like, because I have the story. And when I tell you the story, I can tell all of you the story. You're going to feel bad. When I tell you, even my therapist feels bad. They're like, what happened to you, right? Like, I can make anybody feel bad for me because I have this story. My sponsor didn't care what the story was. She cared about what the truth was currently in my life. And so I went through this process. I did a lot of inventory. I was violently angry for a really long time. There was a lot of pain and a lot of reason for me to be angry. And I had that thing called justified anger, and it's real. Especially when you go through some of the things that I went through. But at 7.5 years sober, when you're still holding on to that same anger, I can tell you it's eating away. And that's what my experience is. And I say that to say that, you know, if you have something that you're writing inventory on and it's the same thing, I encourage you to keep writing the inventory. Because that's what I did. I wrote the same inventory on my father and my stepmother for 7 years. Every inventory was the same. And I did it constantly because I was rageful. I would lay in bed and I would fantasize. And when I say fantasize, because it made me feel good and it made me feel relief and it made me feel okay about beating her with my bare hands. And I knew where it was going to happen, how it was going to happen, and I would play it through. And then I would think about my father and I would be like, I can't wait till he's dying and he's alone and he's all by himself and he can feel what I've felt my entire life from him. Because he's a terrible father. And I had all of this recording of what that was going to look like. And at 7 years sober, I had I'd moved to North Carolina. And when I moved to North Carolina, I thought these people need to, you know, go to Texas and learn how AA is done because they're not doing it right. And nonetheless, I did get to a place, and part of that had to do with hearing one of my heroes when I had been there about 6 months, and I went to this meeting. And in this meeting, he was passionate about Alcoholics Anonymous and service. And he reminded me of my old timers when I first got sober. And I was like, man, and he got sober when he was like 24. And back in his day, that was young. And I was like, I'd never met anybody who got sober really young and had stayed sober. And it was super powerful. And he said, you know, when I'm in a meeting and I'm not hearing the message of recovery, I need to share what was so freely given to me. And not worry about what's being shared in the meeting, but share my experience, because I have a responsibility as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous to pass on what was given to me. And it was like a dagger in my heart. I was like, ooh. And that speaker is what prompted me to go to the first Young People's Conference I had ever been to. And it was Circupon 1996. Because I saw this flyer and I was like, I kidnapped somebody from work. I was like, you're going with me to this conference. And we went. Because I'd stopped going to meetings. I was still calling my sponsor back home, but it was just, you know, because somebody told me to go hear this speaker that I went. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to go to conference, because in Texas, that's what we did. I'd get connected or whatever. And I go to this Young People's Conference, and I'd never been around people my own age sober. And everybody was chanting and acting insane. And I was like, oh my God, my people, you know, like I was so, and they used to do the warm fuzzies. We were talking about that at dinner. And most of y'all probably don't even know what warm fuzzies are, but they had these things called warm fuzzies, and I didn't know how to talk to people my own age, and so that gave me the ability to go up and talk to somebody, because I didn't know how to talk to anybody. And what happened is that weekend, none of us had ever been to a young people's conference. And we ran into a couple of us. We started the first ever young people's meeting where I live in Wilmington. And we put a bid in for that conference. It was a regional conference. It was in Charlotte, North Carolina. And the advisory council awarded it to Wilmington, North Carolina. So it ended up in the same state year to year. And it was powerful. You know, it was really powerful. And I became a part of the host committee and then went on to, you know, be involved in the advisory council. And so during this time, I'm super active in service and I have the sponsor and she's patting me on the back. She's like, keep coming back. It gets better, you know, and I want to go to bed and never wake up again. Because what happened during that time period, and this is a thing for people who come to Alcoholics Anonymous sober, I had 3.5, 4.5, 5.5, 6.5 years sober, and I was acting my age, which means I was doing really inappropriate things, especially when I was going to all these young people's conferences, not sleeping and drinking a lot of coffee. And I eventually wrote inventory on that, and I was like, oh my God, I need to sleep. Because I made really poor choices and I acted like a drunk, essentially. And I was using men like they were like my little toys. Yeah, thank you. I had boyfriends in every single state and, you know, that was my deal. And the thing is that whenever I start living the way that I did when I was drinking, guilt, shame, remorse, all of those things return. Fear. I was living in so much fear and didn't realize it. And I remember going to a meeting during that time and this woman shared about writing inventory on her dog. And I was like, this chick's crazy. And I was like, will you be my sponsor? And so like, I'm so glad I did that because at that time I wasn't actively writing inventory. I had a sponsor that was telling me keep coming back. And my experience is I can't stay sober by going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and just being involved in service. Service is great, but if you're involved in service and you're not working stuff, God bless you, you know, because my experience is there's no better way to get a resentment than being on a YPAW committee, on an advisory council, and especially involved in general service, because people just don't do things right. And so, you know, like, I was stark raven sober, and she, when I talked to her, she said, I want you to read page 52, and I want you to tell me how many of those things are applicable. I don't know if y'all know what page 52 is, but it's the bedevilments. And they're talking about somebody who's coming in like drunk. All of them applied. I was in isolation because fear had returned to my life. And I got busy writing inventory. And during that time, I also had become very angry at my father. And I called her and I was crying because I was mad. I wasn't crying because I was sad. I was crying because that's what I do. When I get like I want to murder somebody, I cry. Any other time, I don't cry. So when I cry, I run. And so like I'm crying, I am rageful, I want to murder him, and I call my sponsor, and she said, when you're ready to write inventory, give me a call. Click. Yeah, I wanted to kill her. And I hit my knees, and I was just bawling, and I was so mad. And I had this vision that day. And I'm not like super woo-woo, even though I did pray to crystals because I didn't believe in anything else. But I like the whole woo-woo thing kind of freaks me out. And so like, but whatever, I was, it was more like an alternative thing as to why I did that. I think an early recovery was to be different. But so at that time, I just was, I was moving towards the Catholic thing, I think, during that time. But anyway, so I'm hitting my knees and I have this vision. And the vision was my father. And when I was 8 years old, we had to go back to the house and we had to pick up all of our stuff. And his eyes were sad. Now, when I go home, I have two amazing German shepherds. They're very smart and they're beautiful. And they love me. Like the one when she was little, she would wet herself. And no other human has ever wet themselves when they see me, but she would always wet herself, and it made me so excited. So I love it when I come home and my dogs are really excited to see me. If they're not, I'm like, are they okay? And then I get mad at them. Like, why aren't you treating me correctly, you know? So, like, I don't have children, so I don't know what it's like when your kids say, I don't want to live with you anymore. But I can tell you that in that moment when I remembered his eyes and I saw that sadness and I just had that recall, it didn't fix any of the things, but it opened my heart to write that inventory one more time. And I wrote that inventory, and I talked to that sponsor, and again, she told me things that I didn't want to hear. But she said, you know what, because I had tried to make amends to my father at one point in time, or at least that's what I called what I was trying to do. But what would happen is he would do things that upset me, and then I would just start calling all the time. And then I would call after a year or a year and a half, and during this time, I'm going home to Texas, and I'm not calling him, letting him know. But he knows that I'm there. Right? I don't know what that feels like either, but I can imagine it doesn't feel good. And so, you know, my sponsor, she said, you know, there's a lot of pain in this relationship. We're going to start this small. I want you to be consistent. When I go into the prisons, you know what? I have to be there, even when I don't feel like it, because if I don't show up to the prison meeting, the alcoholics don't get meetings. So we're going to approach this relationship the same. I want you to write him a letter, same day of every month, on point. Like if it's the first of the month, every first of the month, you write him a letter and you be consistent. So I started writing him letters, and I hated doing it. I didn't know what to say half the time. I was reluctant, but I was consistent because that's what my sponsor taught me. After a year and a half of that, I started calling my father. Again, did not want to do that either. It was uncomfortable. He never called me on my birthday or Christmas. Why should I pick up the phone to call him? Again, I wanted him to die and to be alone. I hated him with every fiber of my being. What happened in that process of about 2.5 years is that somewhere through the process of taking suggestions and doing the things and praying and allowing God into that relationship, my heart changed. And I don't know when or how it changed, but I know that my perspective about that man is totally different today. I know that my worth today is not tied into whether or not my dad loves me. I know that, like, I am okay whether or not he loves me the way that I think a father should love me, because I don't think about those things anymore. You know what I think about? I think about what my responsibility is as a daughter, and that's all I think about, because that's what my job is as an adult human, is to be a good daughter, and that means I had to write a job description of what that looked like, to stay in contact with Dad. Okay, what does that mean? Does that mean call him every week, call him every 2 weeks? I had to have a job description. And so that's the process that started. During that time, I also found out, and I had gone through tons of surgeries. I had cancer, like went through chemo. And my experience is I show up to Alcoholics Anonymous, and Alcoholics Anonymous always shows up to me. I had no family where I lived. I never went without a meal. My sponsees would come. I was in so much pain, I could barely shower. And they would come and they would pray with me. They always brought me meals. It was a powerful experience, and fast forward to this time that I found out I had to have open heart surgery because I had a hole in my heart, and it was really large, and I called my dad to tell him that I was getting ready to have heart surgery, and he said, I'll be there. And I remember thinking very clearly, there's no way he's going to be here. And my dad flew in town along with the rest of my family, and the night before I went into that surgery, I got to look my dad in the eye, and I got to tell him that I was wrong and that he deserved a better daughter than the daughter that I was. I don't know how the transformation of my heart can occur like that, because who I am is, if you hurt me, I will slice your tires and slice your heart, and like I go crazy. That's who I am. You cut in front of me, I'm not well, okay? That's all I'll say. But what happened, I am not capable of, because if I could, like, there's this woman in where I live, and you just look at her, and she's like I think yellow, just happy and joyous. Like, she is a chipper human being every time you see her, and I'm like, it's totally fake. I've known her for years now. I represented her, you know, in my business, and she is always chipper, and she's just a nice person. Me, I am not. If I could make myself be that way, I would do it. I lack power to do that for myself, even when I want to. I want to be a good human today, and I just can't do it on my own. What happened was, through the work, God transformed my heart, and I became a different person. And I looked that man in the eyes. And I'll tell you that was a powerful experience, but what was more powerful was that Alcoholics Anonymous did the other half of that amends, because my dad had no idea what kind of life I lived. When I woke up from that surgery, they asked me who I was. And I was like, what do you mean? You have my chart. Please tell me you have my chart. And they said, people have been calling all over from the United States to check on you. The waiting room was full. When I got out of that surgery, meetings were brought constantly. And who saw all that was my father. He had no idea the kind of life that I had. And he saw you, and he heard stories from you about me. That was the other part of that amends. Today, about a couple, I think it was last year or 2 years ago, my dad made amends to me. I never thought that day would happen, and I had planned out what my dad and our conversation was going to look like. It was not what it ended up looking like. I thought I was going to be very angry, and it was going to be very elevated, and it just wasn't. It was a very calm, peaceful conversation, and my dad told me that I deserved better. And I didn't feel like, yay, I deserved better. I didn't feel that because I already knew I deserved better. I know today what my worth is, and it wasn't based upon what my dad told me that day. That is powerful because I'm not capable of doing that on my own. There's always this inflation of my ego, or it's this deprecation of being the worst, right? Like, I don't know how to be in this place of neutrality. Alcoholics Anonymous gave me that. And I always talk about Dad because he was the hard one. He was hard. My grandparents, God, they were so glad I was sober. It was easy. Mom, easy. Mom, she actually went to her first Young People's Conference because Icky Paw was held in Houston. And I called Mom and I was like, hey, Icky Paw's going to be in Houston. I'm going to be there. You should come meet me. She was still drinking. She shows up. We barely hung out because I was with my friends and she ended up, you know, hanging. I mean, when I was at Young People's, especially at that age, I was crazy. And so, because I was young. And so after the conference, my mom said, man, I wish I was alcoholic. That was amazing. And I'm thinking, you are an alcoholic, you know? I did not say any of those things. A couple years later, what happened is my mom called me because she had hit bottom. And the reason why she called me is because she watched the power of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. And she always says to me, I gave you life, but then you gave me life. I always wanted a mom. Like, I have a life beyond my wildest dreams today. The people in my life are freaking amazing. Like, I have the best friends, and people adore me, and I love when people adore me. But I have an amazing life, but what I always wanted my entire life was a mom. And I would always cry because I didn't have a mom. And Alcoholics Anonymous gave me a mom. I remember at 8 years, her 8 years sober, one of the hardest things I went through in my sobriety, and I say that sobriety has been full of challenges. I've experienced way worse stuff being sober than I did when I was drinking. I've lost people that I've loved. I've experienced extreme health problems. I've, like, you name it, it's happened. It's crazy. Life is crazy. Life is hard. But the thing is that Alcoholics Anonymous is powerful. And there's always these beautiful lessons that happen through that. And I was going through, I remember laying on the floor crying. And years before, I remember a sponsor talking about laying on the floor, like wailing, crying. I remember thinking, that's so dramatic. Because I would never especially do that over a man. But that happened to me, right? And I was heartbroken. Man, there's nothing worse than being heartbroken. Nothing. I felt like everything inside me had been ripped out, and I just wanted to go to sleep and not wake up. I mean, getting your heart broke is terrible. My mom started calling me every single night because, man, when you go through a breakup, what's the hardest time? It's nighttime because you're used to talking to that person on the phone or whatever, right? My mom started calling me every day, and I remember thinking, I had this panic. What if something happens to my mom? And it was just this fear. But it was like God revealing something to me was that I had a mom and she was showing up in my life. This year, she's going to meet me and she's going to go with me to Icky Paw, which is super cool. She loves going to Young People's Conference. She likes hanging out with my friends. I get real resentful about it because they're like, oh, we hung out with your mom last night. We all had dinner. And I'm like, whatever, because I still have friends in Texas and stuff and that are sober. And she's my best friend. She's my person. You know, and I'm so grateful. And, you know, I've experienced having money, not having money, having love, not having love. I have essentially been single for the past 12 years. I haven't had a relationship last longer than probably 90 days in 12 years. The reason why I share that is because oftentimes in my head, I can think like, oh, what's wrong with me or whatever. And And oftentimes, those things, the way that I'm feeling in my head, they have nothing to do with reality. The reason I live the life that I live today is because I choose to. Because I choose to be respected. I choose to be valued. And until I meet somebody that brings the same kind of energy into my life, I don't need somebody just in my life. And when I was young, that relationship stuff was so important. And I don't have to live that way today. You know, I want, like, you know, the Jay-Z to my Beyonce. Like, that's what I want in my life today. And until I get it, bye. But what happens is God puts these things, these people, all of these things into my life that fulfill me. You know, and I have a beautiful life. I get to sponsor women in Alcoholics Anonymous. They say, you know, if you're having trouble with sex, throw yourself into helping others, and God apparently thinks that, because my girls, like, sometimes they drive me crazy. Sometimes I don't want to answer the phone when I see them calling because I have too many of them. That's what I tell myself in my head, right? But the reality is that I pick up that phone and I no longer think about me. It's so amazing. And then my life is great and wonderful. The women that I sponsor, they trust me. During the pandemic, I did get to start speaking in Iran a lot, and during that process, I ended up with a sponsee that lives in Iran, and it has been such a pleasure sponsoring her, hearing her inventory, helping her through the steps. It was during a time that was very hard for me. I live alone. I'm single during the pandemic. Everybody was in their little pods. I didn't have a pod. It was just me, and I felt very isolated. I need people in my life. You know, I'm the type of person, I feel lonely, so then I isolate. It makes no sense whatsoever, but that's what happens. And so I was struggling going to just these online meetings, and I got asked to go to Iran and to take them through the 12 concepts. And it changed my life, because it was like working with a hungry alcoholic, because their structure's so new. And it was amazing and beautiful. And then I end up with this beautiful sponsee, Golly, who is just awesome. And I get to work with her on a regular basis. I have sponsees all over the place. I love them. Oftentimes, I don't want to take their calls because I'm selfish and self-centered. But I was taught in Alcoholics Anonymous that when your phone rings, you answer it. It's a non-negotiable. When I go to my home group, I work the room. I'm not there to hang out with my friends. I'm there to greet people. I don't ever want to do that when I'm wanting to isolate, talk to you. No. I want to go see somebody who's going to make me feel better. My job is to welcome people to Alcoholics Anonymous because somebody was there for me. I had a girl years ago, and I'm going to shut up when I tell this story, because I know y'all want to dance and, you know, important stuff. It is the important stuff. I had this girl, and I was sponsoring her, and she couldn't get it. And during that time, one of my old timers was sick and he was dying. And he was like, he was the old timer. I was thinking when we were clapping for the newly sober people, and only in Alcoholics Anonymous are we at our bottom, and we come in here and we're like, yes, that's awesome, you know? Like, you literally want to die and everybody's clapping, you know, saying, yeah, that's awesome. And that's what he did, was he always built me up. I remember going with him when he would speak, and he would say, little redheaded girl, stand up, and he would have everybody clap for me. And it made me feel so special. Old-timers always made me feel special. And he's dying, and I got to be one of the people to walk him through that process. And during this time, I have this crazy girl who's just not staying sober. I would pick her up. I thought I needed a white chip for taking her to a meeting because she was like reeking of booze. And I'd be like, oh my God, I hope nobody thinks it's me. You know, this is the way my alcoholic mind thinks. And so it was my anniversary, and I had thrown a brunch for all the women that I sponsor because it's about the women that keep me sober. And at the brunch, she broke down and said, I can't stop drinking. I try to not stop, and I always stop, and I drink, and I'm hiding bottles in my niece's, you know, closet. And the next night was my home group, and during that time, Mike is really sick, and I went to the home group, and I saw Keith, who was his best friend, and I asked how he was doing, and he said he's not doing good today. And I remember thinking, man, I need to go see him after the meeting. And at that meeting, that girl picked up her white chip. And at the end of the meeting, she said, can I hang out with you? And I was like, you people will not let me sleep. I'm exhausted. Like, I just done this brunch for everybody. I took you to the meeting. Like, I just wanted to go home and take a shower, right? Like, I just wanted peace. And I was like, of course, I'd love for you to come over. And again, I say that it's just like picking up the phone. Because what happened was something really powerful, and I would have missed it if I didn't say yes. I'm never too busy for an alcoholic that needs help. I remembered that I hadn't been by to see Mike, and we had just gone and gotten ice cream, and I said, do you mind running over there with me? And so we went, and for whatever reason, she got out of the car to walk into hospice with me. And when I got there, his daughter was there, who he didn't have a close relationship with, and he was devout Catholic. And we go in, and she walks in with me, and it's apparent that he's not going to make it through the night. And he's very, like, shallow breathing. And we all sat around, and we all had our hands somewhere on his body. And we started praying, and we prayed his favorite prayer, and that was the rosary. This girl is the most anti-Christian human you'll ever meet. Like, her like the hair on her neck just stands up if you say Jesus. I mean, it's just, like, automatic, right? Like, she can't with it. And she just wasn't raised that way, and so she's real uncomfortable. And we're saying the rosary, his breathing is becoming more and more shallow. And in that moment, he took his last breath when we were sitting there with him. And she came to, after, you know, everything was taken care of there, we went back to my house, and she just started crying. And she said, I don't understand why a drunk like me was there with him. He impacted so many people's lives. Why was I there? And it was so crystal clear to me, even though prior to that I was thinking, of course I was with him, I was his favorite. but when she said that, what I knew was that God had given Mike the opportunity to do his last 12 step. Because in that moment she said, I don't know what happened when he left, but I felt, the only thing I know how to describe is I felt love. And I felt so unworthy to experience that love. That girl is still sober today. That girl is married and has a child. That girl who is unable to call her father has a beautiful relationship with her father. Now, I will tell you, be careful what you tell alcoholics, because I told her she could stay the night and she didn't leave for 3.5 years. After 3 months, she started paying rent, which was good. I believe in the seventh tradition. I don't do that for everybody, but sometimes these crazy alcoholics come into your life and they touch your heart. And it gets to happen to me often. And I'm so extremely grateful that in spite of my selfishness and self-centeredness, which is the root of my problem, it's the problem, it's me, it's always me, that in spite of myself, if I show up and just do these things, my life gets better. I call my sponsor today. Have you prayed about it? I don't want to hear it. I have 20 things that we could talk about of how to solve this problem. Why do I have to pray? Like, my mind still thinks like that. How are your sponsees doing? That's her other question. I called to talk about me, right? I say that to say I'm very imperfect. And that I think sometimes in Alcoholics Anonymous, we think recovery is supposed to look a certain way. And from my experiences is that I am very human. And I'm always, there's nothing that a drink is going to make better in my life. And no matter how bad of something I've done in recovery, there's somebody who's done something worse and they haven't picked up a drink. I don't have to drink. I can have guilt, shame, and remorse, and I have a solution through the steps that's going to give me the ability to live a good life if I choose to just do the stupid work. I can't thank you enough. I have a couple of friends who also came here to hear me speak, and thank you for being here. I don't know. I think Sloan probably already left. She could probably tell my story. She's been here quite a few. Yeah, she's gone. call her out, my friend Nick from Omaha. You know, I appreciate it. I'm blessed. I have a good life. Thank you to the other speakers. I'm really looking forward to tomorrow morning, and thank you for allowing me to be a part of your conference. Thank you.